Welcome to this segment of A Day at DPL, a thought leadership series that is part of the Advisor Revelations podcast. You will hear from DPL's founder and CEO, David Lau, and a special guest where they will discuss educational topics around industry trends and best practices, providing advisors insights to grow your business and better serve clients.
Welcome to A Day at DPL. We've got a terrific guest today, someone that needs very little introduction. We've got Michael Kitsis. Michael, I think everyone knows who you are at this point, so much so that when I was having a conversation literally like last week with somebody in the industry and I brought up your name and they didn't know who you were, I lost immediate respect.
Oh, there's always more people we can teach and educate and get the message out to. So just more people to bring into the financial advisor fold. It's all good.
There you go. So for those of you who don't know, Michael is one of the most influential voices in the advisory space. He reaches advisors in any number of ways, you know, from being an entrepreneur to being, you know, one of the thought leaders through his many channels. And what I thought would be interesting, I mean, you're co-founder of XY, Advice Pay, you of course got Nerd's Eye View that you've had, you know, kind of for a long time, and Kitsis.com. I thought what might be interesting is, in, you know, to give people more of your background, is give a little bit of an origin story. So I'll start you off by saying, I don't know, in 2010, 2011, I want to say, I'm the COO of Jefferson National.
Yeah.
And one of our sales center guys comes in and tells me, I've got a blogger on the line who wants to talk to you about the product that we've got in market and how you built it and how the pricing is. I'm like,
and you're like, what's a blogger?
I'm like, a blogger. I'm like, who the heck is this? And he's like, his name's Michael Kitsis, and I think he has a decent following, actually. And, you know, he's calling in from Virginia, and I'm like, okay, I'm from Virginia. I'll talk to Michael.
So that was our common bond. That was how I actually got the call through. All right. That's good to know.
That's right. And it turns out, you know, you lived about 2 miles from where I grew up. And so this is like, that's early Michael Kitsis days. Yeah. So I didn't know who you were. And like I said, now I look at it is if somebody doesn't know who you are, how tuned in are they? So kind of give me your origin story and kind of your arc. How did it all get started and how did you get to where you are?
If we go all the way back, I mean, even at that point, that was actually sort of collectively halfway through my career. So I started in 2000, like right in the peak of the tech boom. I was a Y2K graduate, undergrad with a liberal arts degree and no idea what I actually wanted to do when I graduated college. I was a psych major, theater minor, pre-med student who didn't want to do psych theater or medicine by the time I was graduating. So I fell somewhat randomly into financial services, just needed a job, financial advisor, things sounded neat. You know, we want hard workers and great income potential and all those things that sounded great to me as a 22-year-old graduating from school. And so I came into the industry like directly out of college. They're like, I graduated Memorial Day weekend in 2000. So that Saturday was graduation. Sunday, I packed everything I owned in my car. Memorial Day Monday, I drove home. And the Tuesday thereafter, I reported for work in the life insurance agency. So I was directly in the industry out of college. I started on the insurance side of the industry.
Don't tell me it was one of those, like, bring 200 names with you and start calling all your friends and family.
Sort of softly and directly. Well, as you know, for the Northern Virginia area where we are, there are some pretty affluent zip codes in this area. And my parents were from one of those zip codes. The problem was they moved there in the 1970s. When that was not an affluent zip code, that was like the drive till you qualify building houses on farmland territory.
I 100% relate to that.
Yeah, like at least with sort of the industry knowledge in retrospect, I'm fairly certain my hiring was probably related to my parents' zip code, except I didn't actually have that network because that was not the part of that zip code that my parents were from that I grew up in. And so I had no natural network. I am actually quite introverted by nature. So like cold calling and cold knocking and prospecting and networking meetings all sounded horrific for me. So I did not succeed in the life insurance and I got to the 1 year renewal contract and my contract was not renewing because I did not have enough production. But I had the dumb luck of mentoring myself under the one CFP in that office of like 30 life insurance agents selling VUL. who just had this different approach where he was like, yeah, I know like everybody else just kind of pitches VUL, but I just do a comprehensive plan for them and I help them with whatever they need. And I was like, that just seems easier. Like, it just seems easier to like ask them what they need and give them that instead of pitching the same thing to every single person until you find one that works. So right. I kind of liked this financial planning thing. I changed firms and went to an independent broker dealer into what I would probably now call a role that was like 50% paraplanner, 50% client service associate. So I was preparing financial plans. This was a firm that like did plans and charged plans for every client and then just helped them implement whatever they might need at the end. So I was building and creating all these plans. I was also on the service end. So like I was doing all the account openings and paperwork and insurance apps and annuity apps and everything in between. So like just really good to learn the brass tacks reality of what it takes to get stuff done in the business. And, you know, a little bit apropos to the discussion, because I was and always have been the nerdy type, you know, as you may recall, like if you go back to 2001, 2002, this was the heyday of the first generation of variable annuity living benefit riders, like the early the early GMIBs and the first round of GLWBs. And so there was a constant flow of wholesalers calling on our office to say like, hey, you want to hear about the new annuity thing? And a lot of our partners at the firm were, I think, frankly, in retrospect, probably just like tired of the number of wholesalers. But I was the sponge that wanted to absorb everything. And so I said, hey, like, I'll take all the meetings. Like, I'd love to learn all about this stuff. And so I took the meeting with every wholesaler. I was the nerd that read every prospectus. I made these like giant comparison spreadsheets to analyze and optimize all the different living benefit riders and annuity riders that were out there. And then that ultimately turned into, from a career end, that was how I finally got into client meetings, because I was so the expert on all the products that eventually when all the partners realized that whenever there was an annuity discussion with a client, they were like, just bring Michael in, like, let him nerd out. They were like, they probably didn't let me out for much else, but they were like, if it's an annuity conversation, like the dude's just going to like wow the clients with his knowledge of everything. And he's analyzed every single benefit to figure out which one is best in every single possible scenario. So they were like, they just let me loose in there. And that was fine. As long as I didn't have to prospect, I was very happy to sit across from clients. Go. I became an annuity nerd that actually turned into an annuity book, which we published with John Olson all the way back in, I feel like 2004, 2005 was the first version of Advisor's Guide to Annuities, which we wrote to actually say like, hey, we can't find anything objective on annuities. There was a bunch of media stuff that totally bashed them. There was some industry stuff that ironically was actually less factually accurate promoting annuities than a lot of the media bashing was taking shots at annuities. So we were like, we're going to write the actual objective book on annuities. And you know, we still updated since sixth edition now as just like a nerd primer on all things annuities. And then eventually I wandered to the RIA channel where for most of the past 15, 20 years, there's been very, very little product availability on the RIA side. And so I moved away from the annuity side of the business as I got into the RIA channel because we just didn't have products for most of it for at least a good 10 plus years until Jefferson National launched something. I called you and was like, what is this thing? We can use it as an RIA? Like, how does this work?
And little did I know at the time, you probably knew more about annuities than I did.
I was pretty deep in them. That you certainly know your space, but I was pretty deep in them. That is fair. I was probably very harshly judging everything you were saying at the time and trying to suss out, like, is this real? Is this legit? Like, I've heard lot of sales pitches. I talked to a lot of wholesalers of varying $20 a quality. Month. Yeah.
So, yeah, that was, you know, one of my, you know, first forays into the annuity space. I've been, you know, in financial services trying to take costs primarily out of distribution from a manufacturing side, whether it's banking, brokerage, insurance, provide better products for the client. So anyhow, before we start jumping a little more into it, tell me how did the blogging start? Then how did you come up with XY and Advice Pay? And you're really an entrepreneur at this point.
The blogging end of it originally started in sort of first form in 2008, really, really earnestly in 2010. Like, I loved research and analyzing all the stuff that was happening coming out in the industry. Back then, I had a particular focus around annuities, retirement, and tax, and all the different intersections of annuities, retirement, and tax. So I was doing all this research. I was reading and absorbing all this stuff. And I'm just one of these people, like, I like learning things, and I like sharing what I learned. And so the early days of the blog for me was, candidly, like, it was really just it was a venue for me to share the learning journey that I was on. And because I was pretty good at nerding out on stuff, and I'd spent 10 plus years of my career in the advisor chair, I really understood like sort of what we're all collectively dealing with as advisors. So when I would go analyze these things and then share it with others, it turned out there were other people having the same problem that found this really useful and started reading the blog and sharing it with their friends. And that's really what built and grew the blog for most of its first 10 years from 2008 to 2018. Over the past 4 or 5 years, we've grown the team out a lot further. There's actually 23 people with the Kitsis.com platform now. So
wow,
multiple people that produce content and do a lot of the educational CE offerings and the rest that happens behind the member section. But for most of that time, it was really me on a learning journey, just saying like, hey, I'm finding this useful stuff that I think would be useful to other advisors as well. I'm going to publish on the internet. And like, it turns out other people really did find that helpful. So we had a lot of people who started coming and reading. And what I found is kind of a byproduct of that. You know, I've always been one of those people that looks at the landscape and sees the gaps. And it's like, no one does that thing. Like, someone should do something about that. And then I look around, no one's doing. I'm like, well, crap, I guess I'm going to do something about it. Like, I'm not good at standing still. Like, there's a problem that nobody's solving. Like, I have to step into this void and solve this thing.
I can relate.
And so part of what emerged with the blog is as we were putting out all this content, and essentially like I would write articles of, oh my gosh, it's so aggravating that no one is doing this thing. Is anybody else really aggravated by this as well? And then a whole bunch of people would come and say like, yes, we agree, right? Like the post would get a ton of traffic and a lot of sharing, right? We can sort of empirically measure like, okay, we hit a nerve with the advisor community. If I found I was writing the stuff that was hitting a nerve, I was like, well, maybe I really should do something about this. And that's basically what came to New Planner Recruiting and FP Pathfinder and XY Planning Network and Vice Pay and all these different businesses that I've built, as including all the particular kinds of education and masterclasses and summits that we do on our Kitsis.com platform, was all kind of born from that as we built an audience talking about things that are relevant for advisors and solving their problems. It's given us a very good indicator to understand how big of a problem certain problems are. And then that sometimes spawns businesses' ideas to actually say like, okay, I validated the need from like a entrepreneurial startup perspective. Okay, let me go find a business partner and put a team together and let's see if we can actually build something, solve this.
So how does your time divide these days? All these things that you've got going on. I'm sure it varies from time to time.
Yeah, I mean, it varies from week to week, but I would say broad slice, it's probably about 2/3 Kitsis.com related and 1/3 sort of all the other companies that I'm involved with and support. You know, I've been very intentional in other businesses that I've started to take on business partners who can manage the day-to-day, because I can't literally like manage the day-to-day of that many teams. I think all of those businesses collectively are now closing in on 175 team members. So like that's way, 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 way too many people to manage. And yes, my natural gift is not management of people. So I try not to put myself too squarely in that position in the first place. So it's about 2/3 on the Kitsis.com side, which you could probably split further to say about 1/3 of my time is creating and delivering content, right? Everything from going out to speak at industry conferences, writing articles for our site, running our own 2 podcasts, Financial Advisor Success and Kitsis and Carl with Carl Richards. So kind of the create and share content is about 1/3 of my time. Actually manage the team of Kitsis with our leadership team is about 1/3 of my time. And the last 1/3 of my time is working with all the business partners I've got at the various businesses I've created, working with the Buckingham team, because I'm also a part of Buckingham Wealth Partners, which is an advisory firm that does both private wealth to clients and back office investment management for other advisors. So that kind of tail of so-called like Kitsis related businesses, as it were, takes about 1/3 of my time doing a lot of, you know, strategy and visioning and a bit of marketing and product iteration for those offerings.
I'm sure that's like 40 hours a week then.
Yeah, give or take a little. So I'm actually one of those people that tracks my own time quite meticulously. I'm sort of like you can't really improve your productivity unless you're taking a hard look at where your time's actually going and actually doing something about it if it's not really going to the best and ideal places. So I can tell you empirically, I really do work about probably 52 to 55 hours a week. and I really work those hours. Yeah. I mean, I know a lot of people like, yeah, I work 60 hours a week, and I'm like, yeah, but like 15 of it was like surfing social media for extended periods of time. I'm like working for about 50 hours, 50 to 55 hours a week. I basically work about 8:30 a.m. to 6:30 p.m. Monday through Friday, which are 10 hour blocks. And then I've got like two or 3 hours in the mornings on Saturday and Sundays while the kids are off at sports activities or Sunday school. I'll get a little bit of stuff done while the house is quiet.
Cool. So I wanted to have you on. We spoke, you know, a few weeks ago and had some interesting conversation. So I'll put the, you know, context like this. I'll turn it back to what you were talking about like seeing problems and voids and needing to fill it. So when I was building Jefferson National, one of the things that happened was I expected other carriers to come into the market and to kind of come into the market with the market being the RA market, with their best products, but just commission free.
Yeah, just like strip the distribution costs out. Just like repackage the thing without the distribution costs and off you go.
In the simplest way, right? That could be the simplest thing that could happen. What happened was a couple of carriers, because insurance carriers are very product focused. Mm-hmm. We launched a particular product. It was an investment-only variable annuity. And that's because we were a very small insurance company. We didn't have a big balance sheet to do big guarantees and stuff like that.
Actually, like reinsuring that would be difficult at that size and scale. Yeah,
exactly. And I thought, okay, I kind of modeled it off Schwab OneSource a little bit. Let's build this product with loads of investment options. Yep. And it'll be a tax-deferred OneSource. And advisors used, you know, Schwab was even more dominant in market share on the custodial business at that time. So anyhow, that was the notion. And so what happened with carriers was they tried to launch some version of that product and say, okay, that product's the key to the RIA market. And it's like, no, it's not. No. It's not. That's a product. And
it's a product. Yeah.
It's a product. And it's not all about the product. It's also the fact that we're not going to come knock on your door wholesaling, you know, once every 3 weeks. We're going to market to you differently. We're going to engage with you differently. We're going to give you technology tools. We're going to meet the needs of your business, you know, in terms of allowing fee billing and, you know, management of the assets through models and things like this that, you know, carriers just didn't get. It's just, okay, I launched the product and it's all about the product. So eventually, after I'd been there 10 years and thought I kind of figured it all out, like these are all the issues that advisors have and carriers still don't get it. So let me launch this platform and go work with carriers, teach them what I learned. And like, this is how you go about winning the RIA market, is building products that can be used, not sold, you know, not lots of gimmicks. Let's strip out the costs. Let's build understandable products with good benefits.
Yep.
So that's, you know, what we just continue driving to do.
Yeah.
And it's one of the simple notions that I love that can kind of convey, but it's so hard for carriers to get their head around products that can be used, not sold.
Yeah.
So just a little commentary.
Yeah. I mean, I've seen the same thing, but I would certainly echo your comments that, yes, I mean, the IOVA was to me sort of an interesting niche kind of product that solved a certain set of scenarios, or like, I just need a tax deferral wrapper. I've got an old high cost annuity and I don't want to eat the gains. So I need a 1035 destination, or they're kind of like a good list of one-off scenarios that if you have enough advisors with enough clients, like you inevitably are going to get some volume of people that need to solve this problem. So off Jefferson National went. But to me, like, and I mean, just if you literally looked at sales flows in the annuity space, like that's not actually the primary problem that annuities were used to solve. There's a whole bunch of other use cases around managing risk and retirement income guarantees and other pieces with it that I had, I guess, similarly lamented from our end. You know, we kept doing updates to the book every 3 years. And we're like, this is finally the year we'll get to talk about more annuities with actual guarantees on the RA side. I was like, nope, not yet. All right, well, 3 more years. Like this can be the addition update. Like, crap, nope, not yet. We're still not there yet. And yeah, I feel like there is this phenomenon where, you know, the message to carriers was simply like, look, we're RAs. We literally can't take the distribution costs, and we'd rather they just not be there. Like, we will literally sell you without the costs if you just remove the darn thing. And at some point, you know, perhaps sort of indirectly because of the success I think you did have with Jefferson National, the perception I found from a lot of carriers became, you know, all RIAs wanted was the annuities without the distribution costs. And somehow they translated that into annuities with no costs and no features. And like, I wasn't actually looking for a featureless annuity. I'm just looking for one without the distribution.
That's right.
Like, I might actually want some of the other versions of the benefits. And in fact, maybe you could even price them a little bit more favorably for my client when I don't need the distribution layer in there. And I've watched it still be a struggle. You know, I do some consulting work back to some of the carriers as well around kind of the RIA space and working with the RIA space and building product for them. I still remember a conversation with one of the carriers. I won't name them because they actually figured some of this out and are doing well, but it was a little rough in the early years. And I was doing some consulting work with them. This is probably like 2019, because I think it was pre-pandemic. So it must have been like 2019. And they said, like, look, we're working on a version of one of our living benefit riders. And so they had like this grid where different withdrawal rate, there were like four different withdrawal rates and five different age bands for the client. And they were like, you know, and so you look up on your client, like if it's this withdrawal tier in this age band, then it has this cost and benefits. And if it's this one, it has this. And they were like, so like, we made this thing. What do you think? And I was like, let me tell you how this is
going
to work.
I know where this is going.
Let me tell you how this is going to work with our firm. I'm going to take this grid to our investment team and they're going to reverse engineer all 20 boxes of this 4x5 grid. And they're going to figure out which single box has the best IRR for my client of any of the 20 boxes. And we will do 100% of our tickets into that one box. We're never going to write a ticket in the other 19. Right. And for the rest of our time working with your company, we will resent and distrust you because you put the other 19 on the table and made us do extra work to figure out which ones we're going to screw our clients. If you gave me the one product in the one box that's best that I could trust, I would do a lot of business with your company with sort of asterisks, some other operational things that we may talk about. But this whole nature of we're going to make all these product grids, like I know you're going to make better margin on some than others because there's just a level of a pricing and efficiency that has to happen when you put a product to market. Like, don't make me do the extra work and then resent you for the fact that you were trying to gouge my clients if I didn't play the game right. Like, it's not a positive relationship. And the comment I gave back to them was, you know, look, I'm just going to compare this to a company like, look at DFA, which I think back then, you know, 2018, 2019, they're like 25 years in. I think they were already at $500 billion or more. I was like, let's just reflect on this for a moment. Like, you guys are still trying to wrap your minds around the possibility that like RAs might use your products even though you don't pay them, which is like antithetical to an annuity carrier that's only ever paid for distribution all their lives.
And it still is now. Yeah. I mean, stunning. Still have those conversations all the time.
So like, let's look at a company like DFA. So here's a company that just tried to make the best product they possibly could. They only made it available to advisors because it was an advisor-offered thing. They don't pay you any commissions to sell it. It's an advisory product. And you have to pay your own way to fly to Austin to learn how to sell the product they won't pay you for.
That's right.
And they got $500 billion by just making something good and getting all the distribution costs out of the way and making advisors proud to use it. And not trying to game them through it. And to me, there's still a version of that opportunity, I think, on the table in the annuity space. I think it's getting a little bit better. Some carriers are starting to get and understand the opportunity. But as you said, there's a product mindset I find still at most carriers of like, we need to have this array of things because people sell different stuff in different situations and you know, we'll average it out on the cost and the profitability. It's like, no, just give me the best darn thing that you can and whatever area you want to be dominant in. And you can have like all my business if you do that. But I need something that's actually factually superior for my clients.
Right. So, I mean, you know, some of the things, you know, carriers really needed to understand, it's again, like I was saying earlier, it's not just about the product. It's, you know, one, about the product. Let's give a good product and then let's make it easy to use. Yep. You know, additionally, you know, and let's support the advisor's business model. So, you know, when I talk to, you know, carriers now, it's still stunning. Like when we say, look, fee billing is important. You know, we have to be able to bill fees. We have to be able to support fee billing in whatever way the advisor wants to do that. And they're like, well, we don't do that. So is there a different way around it? It's like, okay, well, in your regular commissioned world, would you say, hey, we don't know how to pay the commission, but we hope you'll still do it and we'll figure out how you get paid? It's like, no, you can't do that.
You do have to solve for billing. Like, it's not, well, it's not all about the money per se, because the whole point is like, we sell the products that are right for the client and get paid a fee to do that. You're not paying me for distribution. But if my client arrangement and billing process tied to your product, like, you do have to be able to facilitate this. Like, I don't need you to pay me, but I don't work for free. I do need to get paid somehow.
That's right.
To be an economically viable business.
Yeah. And it's not hard. It's just different. They have to make a little investment. We give them, you know, the guidance on how to do it. But, you know, we've built, I guess, some automated version of young Michael Kitz's that does analysis of products. You know, we've got a digital product catalog.
I've been digitized. AI is an amazing thing. It's great.
There you go. We built a digital product catalog that models like 3,200 annuities and 10,000 riders. And yeah, you would love it. So one of the examples of this is, you know, so we're finding the best product for your client given the need. So we're doing the work to go through the grid, right? And find the right grid. So you tell us, here's my client, here's what we're looking to do, here's when they want income, whatever the problem we're solving is. Then we're running 1,000 Monte Carlo simulations across all those products and saying, well, here's the best one. But the point being, some of them will often come out, okay, this is the best one, but it doesn't support fee billing. Well, guess what? Number two then wins, because it does support fee billing, right? So, you know, carriers are starting to learn that. Yep. Like, you have to provide not just the product, but you've got to provide the rest of the support as well.
To me, the real breakthrough comes when we get to the next level of support. Like, I kind of think of it in there's a couple of tiers around what kind of has to get done operationally behind the scenes to make RIA adoption of annuities viable, right? Like, to me, just number one was you have to solve the billing function. I mean, just pure sense, like, I do need to be able to work in a manner that I get paid by my clients, or this is going to be a problem.
Well, even more fundamentally to our original conversation, you need the products, right? So we've worked hard on getting the products. Yes. So you have to have the products.
Yes. But to me, like, even once you've got the product, and like, not to belittle how much of a challenge that's been for 10, 15, 20 years.
Yep.
First, like, I got to be able to get paid. Yep. Second is, for most of us in the RIA channel where we're managing client households holistically, I need to be able to report on this, right? So then the question is, like, can you pull some reporting in? And I know, like, some of those integrations are starting to get built. And then it's like, can you make the application process a little bit easier, right? Like, can we at least start form filling data and such? But to me, there's still a fundamental breakdown even when we get to that level of efficiency, because when I look at this in the context of a large firm, right? If I'm a, if I'm a multi-billion dollar advisory firm and I've got thousands of clients, when I'm tackling an issue like this, I mean, for most of us in the advisory world, most clients are on standard models. We have some range of models from very conservative, very aggressive, and solve some particular needs. Maybe I got an income-specific model, but like, most of us increasingly are evolving in a model-based direction. Which means if I add something to the model, every client gets it in whatever that allocation is. If I decide I want this new bond fund in the new rate environment, like, every client is getting that bond fund. So if I decide, like, hey, I've got 1,000 clients who are millionaires and I'm managing $1 billion and like, I want to put a 5% allocation to this new bond fund, like, our investment team queues it up. We can work out the whole trade order, set up the trade file, send it off. And like, this is done in a few hours on an afternoon. If I said like, no, I'm actually finding that like some of the MIGAs have a better yield than some of the bond funds, I want to use a 5-year fixed annuity in order to do this. It's like, cool. 1,000 applications that each client has to sign. So like, okay, great. We can automate some of the data in and expedite this a little bit, but we're still going to be down to like, my team's got to send it out. They got to make sure it comes back. They got to do follow-up for the clients that don't send it back. They got to answer some questions for clients that ask questions like, why are you giving me paperwork for this? Because I thought you had discretion and you don't ask me about any of the other things. Or like, if this tacks on like just like 20 or 30 minutes per client of team time across 1,000 plus clients, like, I literally have to hire a full-time staff member to handle thousands of hours of work to do one annuity transaction, and that just gets them in. Never mind right. when they want cash out or they want to move something or I have to figure out how to rebalance around this. So, I mean, like the most fundamental challenge I think that we lack in the annuity world is that just the annuity regulatory framework does not have a chassis of what does it mean to be an annuity fiduciary. Right. Yeah. In the investment world, I can be an investment fiduciary. I take on a whole bunch of liability and a lot of stuff that I got to do. And in exchange, yep. I can trade with discretion. I don't need to send my clients paperwork every time I'm going to do a new transaction. They've granted me discretion. We have an investment policy statement about what the parameters are, and I can just go and execute on their behalf. And we don't even have a framework yet for like what it means to be a fiduciary in the annuity insurance realm. But to me, like that's what's missing. When we can get to the point where I can just say, yes, I'm block signing for 1,000 clients to go into this annuity, the way that I can block trade 1,000 clients into a bond fund. That's the point where suddenly firms like, yeah, this MYGA thing seems appealing in this rate environment. Like, here's a $50 million ticket across 1,000 clients, and big numbers start moving in the annuity realm.
Exactly. And I love those. One of the conversations we were having, whatever, a couple of weeks ago, which I just love hearing because this is what I've been talking to carriers about. So carriers, you know, going back to their nature, are always focused on the individual sale. So right. there, it's all individual one-off sales yeah. with painful applications.
Otherwise known as like literally not scalable, like yes. anti-scale.
The definition of not scalable, right? Yeah. You know, an efficiency consultant comes in and looks at that and it's like, oh my God, I've got work for the next 10 years, right?
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But this is the problem. It's they're so used to the individual sale. And to your point, I'm trying to tell them you shouldn't be thinking about the individual sale as an individual client for $150,000 MYGA. You know, we should be wanting individual yeah. firms with $50, $100 million allocations, you know, to a product.
Correct. But in that realm, I mean, I've talked to a few carriers. They're like, hey, like we're making the paperwork more efficient. Why don't you do it? Like just put some resources to do it. And I'm like, yeah, but like if my allocation to your annuity means I literally have to hire and train an entire staff member to do the paperwork for one transaction, I literally yeah. have to raise my costs. Like I'm going to have to raise yeah. my fees to clients to cover my staff overhead. And if I have to raise my fees just to cover the operational paperwork for your offering, it's not cost effective to my client anymore. Like you're literally killing your own economic advantage in the product by burying me in non-scalable execution challenges. And like, I don't want to totally denigrate the benefits that have come from just like the integrations to CRM systems. And like, at least we can pre-populate the forms a lot more than we could yep. a couple of years ago. Like, I don't want to belittle how significant those are.
Yep.
But to me, like we're still an order of magnitude off
yes.
in what actual scalable really mean. Like to replicate the scalability of any other investment I could buy except an annuity in a client's investment portfolio.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, you know, we're working hard on all these kind of issues. So yeah. knocking down the ones that are, you know, quote unquote easier,
yeah.
you know, getting the application easier, getting pre-filling happening, bringing digitization yeah. to the process, getting to straight through processing on individual applications.
Yes.
We can control that. We're delivering that. We're going to have that particular thing straight through processing by the end of the year. But the bigger idea, the more important bigger idea is what you're just talking about. And, you know, in the light of the DOL fiduciary rule that's, you know, now resurfaced in a slightly different form, you know, the insurance industry has been, you know, very opposed to the rule. They're afraid of change, which is natural.
Yeah. Well, you know, we started doing the regulatory changes to kill mutual fund commissions. And then DFA got $500 billion by having no load funds that you have to pay money to learn how to sell for free. Like, the market is so amazingly good. Like, you know, they're terrified of crossing the mountain. I'm like, you don't understand how much greener the grass is, really actually is. On the 100%. Other side, like the RIA community moves so much more money with increasing dollars, increasing flows with very, very large tickets. But like we run scalable businesses. Like the individualization for us comes at the client relationship advice level, right. not at the product level. We try to standardize the products and customize the advice. and they're still coming at us with this like customized, personalized every single product for every single client. I'm like, I can't scale that. Like I would have right. to charge my clients so much more money to do that as a large firm that they won't pay the fees anymore because it's actually not cost-effective advice when you do it that way.
Right. And what you were describing is exactly what I've been talking to carriers and other industry groups about relative to this. Do not fight the fiduciary. Embrace the fiduciary rule. You know, embrace it and embrace and take it the next step and go to discretion. So you should say, hey, we're going to embrace fiduciary. We're going to be all about fiduciary. But in doing that, we would like to give advisors discretion, you know, to open policies on behalf of their clients. Yeah. And I think that, like you said, there's so much, you know, green grass over there.
Yeah.
That, you know, the annuity industry is having record sales now. These years of sales would be so dwarfed by what is possible in solving the discretion scale problem that it's hard to quantify.
I don't have numbers handy, but, you know, Paul, I know annuity industry numbers are up, but like, look at the flows into annuities and then look at the flows into bond funds from Morningstar. It's like, that's the size of the market opportunity you're missing. And it's much larger than, than the annuity side.
Yes, by multiples. I mean, last year was a record annuity sales year of, I think, just under $400 billion. But, you know, part of that, and this was another thing we talked about, I think, at another conference we ran into each other at, is part of that, though, is just recycling money. It's 1035 exchanging from one product to another.
I've always wondered, I guess, shout out to our friends at LIMRA. Like, if you all could do, maybe they have this and I haven't seen it. Like, if you could do a chart that breaks out annuity flows into new flows versus recycling existing dollars, right? Like, in the investment industry, NNA, net new assets, is sort of like a benchmark number that firms track. Like, I would love to understand what the actual net new assets into the annuity side is versus the recycling of the products. Only because I think sometimes the industry is even fooling itself around like, well, our flows are actually pretty good. And it's like, no, you're basically just like rearranging your own deck chairs on your ship. Like, the actual opportunity is over yonder, but you have to get honest about how little the net flows actually are into the segment in the aggregate relative to what's in the investment realm. To understand if you can actually do this scalably in investment firms, like, your numbers get much, much, much bigger.
That's right. And so it is still massively 1035, you know, the business. In the last couple of years, it's been a little different because banks haven't really been selling CDs. They're selling MIGAs instead. Yep, so you're seeing new money into MIGAs.
But- One, I remember we had a phase of that, what would it be, a little over 10 years ago, like when the Fed first did their cuts after 08, 09, I remember similar, like there was an explosion of MIGAs as rates got really low and banks were like, oh, it's actually more cost. We actually make more by disintermediating our own CDs into into MIGAs than we do making it off of the bank spread. So, you know, we're doing another one of those cycles. They come and go.
Exactly. So I know we've got to wrap up, but there's just one more point relative to that I wanted to make is, you know, for carriers, one of the challenges we run into as we work with them on the product side is duration. So they're very used to the duration of their products being surrender period plus a day. Right. So it gets through the surrender period, then it gets recycled, you know, some commission person resells it again. This is another benefit, I think, of the RIA market to an insurance carrier. The duration of those assets should be as long as the product remains viable and a good product for the client. There's no monetary incentive, particularly while we still have painful application processes to go through to move the assets.
Yeah, I'll be fascinated. I mean, just, I know we literally need like a certain collective amount of data, you know, industry-wide and across the various carriers for them to do their math. Like, I'm fascinated to know what the actual persistency trends are going to be. Because at least the conversations I've had with some carriers, and I mean, David, I know you talk to them far more than I do, so I don't know if you've heard this echoed as well. There at least is a perception I found of, no, the thing that drives persistency is an agent who talks to the client regularly and keeps them on board. Granted, it keeps them persistent to surrender period plus one day, but at least it keeps them through that time period. And there's this idea and mentality of, well, if you work with a fee-based advisor that doesn't have any skin in the game and a risk of a chargeback, that the persistency is going to be really low on these policies and they're going to get like churned and moved all over the place. I'm like, again, like, I don't think you understand how the advisor market works. Like, we work, you know, I mean, compared to commissions, like, we work for a really skinny ongoing fee. The only way we survive is we have to service the heck out of our clients every single year, because we wake up on January 1st and go, look at all the annually recurring revenue I've got, as long as I don't screw this up. And so we reinvest into team, we reinvest in the service, we reinvest into more advisors that do more service work and engage with clients, because we're hyper-focused on keeping them engaged. And so, you know, like, a lot of advisory firms see, you know, 95%+ retention rates on clients, and a lot of the last 5% is like death and things that we can't solve for. And, you know, if it's a good product, like, we hold it indefinitely. There's literally no reason to trade it. So I do think you're right that there's a lot of opportunities for increased persistency, which also does some interesting stuff actuarially. Well, ironically, like, better for some products, ironically worse for some others that are maybe a little more lapse supported pricing than they should be.
Yes.
But I do think there's a misunderstanding in the carrier space of this idea that if an advisor wasn't paid a commission and isn't at a risk of a chargeback, that the persistency is going to be lower. And just knowing what I know for a career in the advisory world, mostly in the RIA side, like, I think they're going to be drastically surprised that the persistency very much swings the other direction.
Yeah, because the surrender period is a safety net and a mechanism for getting the commission back, of course. And we push, most of our products don't have surrenders, even the fixed products. They have, you know, MVAs, because I want them to work.
Yeah, you just something to manage the duration exposure for the insurer.
Yeah, you want it to work like a bond, right? So again, relate it back to the RIA and how they work. But that's so scary for a carrier. It's like, we don't have any idea what this looks like. No surrender period. My gosh, it could leave tomorrow. It's like, yes, it could. But as long as you're providing a good product, it won't.
Yeah. Why would it? When you actually made a good thing. Like, have you tried winning on product quality?
Yes. Terrific.
Hypothetical.
The hypothetical novel concept. Yeah. But anyhow, Michael, this has been fantastic. We could go on forever, I feel like. But I really appreciate the time. I know you've got some travel coming up. So safe travels. I don't know if you have any final words.
No, just, you know, if you want to nerd out with more of us on this stuff, Kitsis.com is our platform. We talk about all things industry trends and annuities and practice management and retirement and everything in between. So thank you for the opportunity, David.
Awesome having you. And again, I would recommend, you know, checking out Kitsis.com. You don't want to be that person who doesn't know who Michael Kitsis is when his name comes up. Anyhow.
Oh, I appreciate that.
Fantastic, Michael. Always great to talk with you.
Likewise. Thank you, David.
Take care.
Thanks for listening. To hear more advisor revelations, go to dplfp.com and subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming app.